Good morning. I'm Kathleen Dunn, and you are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Wednesday, the 15th of December. Broadcasting today from Madison, I have some business to attend to in this fair city after this show, so I'm here with Rhonda, and it's a whole new thing. You know, you got to get used to. You have this little studio that you're used to, and I'm in a new place, but it's fine. We have two very interesting programs for you today. We've talked so much the last few weeks about the tax cuts, and as you heard on the news, the Senate is going to vote on the tax bill probably early this afternoon. We have not paid a lot of attention to how this bill will affect the poor among us, and we will take a broader look at the poor among us the first hour of today's program with Professor Catherine Newman. She's a widely published expert on poverty and the working poor, and she is at Johns Hopkins. She is the dean of the School of Arts and Sciences. She has written 9 books and has 2 more in progress and has focused much of her scholarly work on the lives of the working poor and mobility up and down the economic ladder. She's investigated the impact of tax policy on the poor, the history of public opinion's impact on poverty policy, school violence, and the impact of globalization on young people in a number of different countries. So she will be with us as we look at poverty. I'm kind of out of my element today, so I didn't read all the newspapers I normally read because I couldn't find them. But I did have a copy of USA Today, and it was interesting. There was an interesting story on the front page that looked at the letters that young people are sending in this country to Santa Claus, and instead of asking for the usual toys, many of them are asking for clothes, for mittens, for coats, for boots, which I thought was striking and certainly says something. Our number 2 of our program, we're all aware of the large demonstrations that have been taking place in England as there will be changes in terms of college tuition. The annual fees are going to be up to £9,000, which is roughly about, what, $14,000, between $14,000 and $15,000. The government has said the reforms are fair and affordable for the nation. It got us thinking about college education all over the world and in an economic downturn. How are various governments dealing with college education? How do people pay for education in various countries? What's affordable? Are there any countries that still offer this for free? And what's happening in the United States as well? So that should be a good conversation, hour number 2. We welcome your phone calls. Oh, here's the number. We welcome your phone calls. As always, here's the number, 800. It's new today, so if you have the other number in your head, just get rid of it for today. It's 800-642-1234. 800-642-1234. And we can send emails, and that's the normal thing that you would use, which is talk@wpr.org, talk@wpr.org. Just one more announcement. We are doing comedy. Rhonda made me a tape, and as I was driving over from Milwaukee to Madison last night, I was just laughing the whole way. We're doing comedy. It's mostly classic comedy, and we're just going to have a rip-roaring good time. It's good for us to do this every now and then. Tomorrow at 10 o'clock, tune in, and we'll have some laughs. We start our show this morning with Professor Catherine Newman. Professor Newman, thank you so much for being with us.
My pleasure.
We've spent an awful lot of time, and it looks like this tax bill is going to be voted on in the Senate and probably passed early this afternoon. A lot of the complaints have been about the breaks for the wealthy, the inheritance estate tax part of this bill. What do you think this bill does for the poor among us?
Well, the most important thing that it does is preserve the earned income tax credit, which is a critical source of income for poor workers in the United States and their families. The history of the federal government's tax treatment of the poor over the last 25 years or so is actually a very positive, progressive one if we're talking about the working poor. People who are in the labor market, families who were in the labor market were able to see more funds coming back to them through the earned income tax credit over the last 25 years than has ever been true before. And that has had very salutary effects on the federal level. That EITC was one of the things initially threatened by conservatives And the Obama administration was able to bargain to preserve it. So it means that there isn't a net negative for them, but there could have been, and it would have been catastrophic if that had happened.
Mm-hmm. Was there some kind of trade-off here that the poor would have received more if the rich had received less?
Well, it's always possible, of course, that we could have seen an expanded earned income tax credit, for example, or a higher minimum wage. There are many distributional questions here that are quite serious, and I'm not myself thrilled to see how the upper income brackets were treated. They clearly got the lion's share of all of this, but the threat to the poor was quite real, and I think that's probably what the Obama administration was most worried about, seeing that EITC at risk. And I should add that there have been other periods in which the EITC was at risk. In the Bush administration, for example, it was threatened with removal by conservatives. And again, that would have been truly catastrophic.
Professor Newman, explain more what the earned income tax credit is.
So when a family right around the poverty line and below, is receiving earned income, meaning they're receiving wages. When they file their tax forms, they receive a rebate from the federal government if they are below a certain income level. And that is so it's a tax credit, but it's a refundable tax credit. And so it actually is cash in the pocket if they're working and receiving a low income. So it's a hugely important injection of resources in the sense that they're receiving back tax money that otherwise would have disappeared into the tax coffers. And it can be a fairly substantial amount of money. If for a family of four at the poverty line, which today is about $22,000, you know, that could be as much as $2,000. And that is a hugely important source of support for them. So it's a tax credit that becomes refundable.
Mm-hmm. If you were in the Senate early this afternoon, how would you vote on this bill?
It would be difficult. I'm glad I'm not a politician, I have to say, because the fairness issues are very, very serious here. I mean, there is no question that the wealthiest Americans really made out like bandits in all of this. And so it's difficult to defend from a fairness point of view. It really is. It's just that having seen what could have been the alternative for the poor, that would be much more frightening to me. So I would probably hold my nose over it, and I probably would try and seek some amendments to it. I was disturbed by what happened with the inheritance tax. I think the preservation of this tax relief for the very wealthiest Americans really has no justification. The question is, what's the realpolitik of it, and what would happen to the nation's poor if this fragile consensus broke down? And knowing that threat was there would worry me a lot.
Mm-hmm. And what about this fragile consensus? There are reports now that it is beginning to break down, that some members of the Tea Party are very unhappy about this and don't want it to pass. And once we go to the House again, it's just going to maybe unravel.
It's possible. That is always possible. I think that the urgency of the deadline of December 31st would probably motivate everyone to try and go back to the drawing board, because the conservatives definitely don't want to see those tax breaks expire. And I'm not totally clear that the Democrats are all that different. There is some research to suggest that Democrats also look to the high end of their base and worry about the consequences if those tax cuts evaporated. My own personal view is that we could stand to temper the enormous largesse that the wealthiest Americans have received over the last 10 to 20 years, including these Bush tax cuts. But I would worry a lot about the threats to people at the very, very bottom and to those who are unemployed. I mean, those are very real and very vulnerable people out there. And I think the need to protect them is very high indeed.
Why is it then that the Republicans and the Democrats, if you've said here, are worried about the high end of their base? Why? Are they getting money from them, or they think they're going to somehow stimulate the economy?
I definitely think they get money from them. I mean, there's no question about it. But both the Democrats and the Republicans depend upon wealthy people to help support their campaigns And unfortunately, money plays a very loud role in American politics. I don't think that's to our credit. I think it does warp our democracy in some fundamental ways, but that is the reality of the situation, and it's one of the reasons why I think the Democrats don't campaign quite as hard against the expiration of these, against the tax cut situation as we might expect them to.
Even though the vast majority of the American people say we don't need those tax cuts for the very wealthy.
That's exactly right. But, you know, the vast majority of Americans are often confused about what these tax bills will produce. You can, and the newspapers do routinely produce reams and reams of evidence that the vast majority of these breaks are going to people who really don't need it. But it doesn't always make the dent in public opinion that one might expect.
Right. Let's spend just a moment before we go to phone calls on this unemployment situation, which is almost 10%. I'm wondering where the Democrats and the Republicans are and if they can be somewhere to get some jobs for people. That's what they need. You got to have a job in
order
to pay the bills.
Well, I couldn't agree with you more. And I think the biggest failing of the Obama administration was not to focus from the very beginning on jobs. I know that they expected the stimulus to have very positive effects. And it did, in the sense that unemployment didn't get even worse. And it could have been. And it's difficult to campaign on something that could have been worse because people can't see the effect as clearly. But had the stimulus not been there, we would have seen the kinds of layoffs we're now seeing in the states begin last year. And it would have just added to the unemployment totals. They could have been truly, truly catastrophic as it was. They were just terrible. And they're still terrible, and they're about to get worse because the states have run out of money, and they're going to start laying people off, and then we will see, you know, the possibility of a second recession following. The unemployment situation is completely catastrophic, in my opinion, and it has terrible consequences for young workers entering the labor market for the first time who may bear lifetime scars from their entry into a bad labor market, for families whose breadwinners are in their 50s, which is not very old these days. People in their 50s have kids in college, have mortgages that have not been paid off. They have tremendous financial responsibilities, the likes of which would not have been the case probably if we roll back 30 years or so. But today, 55 isn't very old in terms of the social responsibilities that families have, and those workers have taken it on the chin. Minorities, young minorities, terrible, terrible unemployment
yes.
rates with lasting consequences. My own view is that direct federal job creation of the kind that we saw work so effectively and so quickly in the New Deal ought to have been on the table from the beginning, but it's a minority perspective.
Let's go to a phone call. Our number, by the way, is different today. I'm broadcasting from Madison with the very able assistance of Rhonda Fanning, who's helping me through this. The call-in number is 800-642-1234 for today, 800-642-1234. And we start our calls with Rick from Menominee Falls. Hi, Rick.
Hi. Thanks very much for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm calling in regard to the alternative minimum tax. To the best of my knowledge, that has not been repealed. So if we do, in fact, get a tax reduction by repealing this tax cut or tax increase, the alternative tax is going to put it right back on for the middle class, and the rich are just going to gain everything. Is that correct?
You raise a good point, and to be honest, I don't know where we are in the negotiations about the alternative minimum tax. There was a provision in one iteration of this bill that did prevent more people from creeping into the alternative minimum bracket, but I don't know where the negotiations are right now, to be honest.
Thanks very much for your call. Let's go to Sharon, who's calling from Duluth next. Sharon, hi, you're on the air.
Hi, thank you. I heard a quote by a Canadian caller last week on Wisconsin Public Radio, by the way, the best place to listen, and I thought it was kind of pertinent to this. He said, my American neighbors, only in America would you find politicians agonizing and debating over, okay, we have to cut the food stamp program so we can afford a better lunch program for children, and we don't have enough money for these community clinics. We'll have to cut here and there. and all these sorts of agonizing decisions. And yet, when it comes to taxing people who are multimillionaires, there's all this problem. And I think your guest brought up something that seems like we have no way out of. If our politicians are so influenced by money, how are we ever going to get what we need for the average person in this country?
Well, there's a question. How are we ever? Professor Newman.
Well, I think the volume and the loudness of money in the system does not help us get to that goal. I think it's going to take social movements of the kinds that we saw around the Great Depression to make people realize how desperate so many American families are. I think they're going to have to register their sentiments at the polls. You know, the last election did not create the kind of groundswell for protection of the average person. I use that word advisedly here, the country elected a much more conservative legislature, and they are pursuing exactly the policies that they campaigned for. I don't think we should be surprised by what we see. But I think if people out there feel that this is the wrong direction, they're going to have to make that clear at the ballot box, because where else does it really count? I mean, we're asking those of us who think that some of these policies are misguided are asking a Democratic Party that has been beaten back in the numbers to pull off the miraculous in the face of growing Republican numbers in the legislature. I'm not sure what we thought we would get out of this other than what we're seeing.
Professor Catherine Newman is our guest. We're going to take more phone calls for her in a moment. We're talking about the poor among us and how they are faring with the tax bill, which the Senate will probably pass, news is, early this afternoon. What are the provisions for the poor in this tax cut? And how do we take on this horrendously high unemployment rate? How do we make sure that people have, you know, it's a perennial question, jobs that will allow them to put food on the table and clothes on their back and get to work and have a decent life? Our phone number in Madison today, 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234. The email is the same, talk@WPR.org, talk@WPR.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn. You are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. The second hour of our program this Wednesday will be looking at the cost of higher education, the demonstrations that took place in England, how the United States is dealing with the cost of higher education, how England is, and other countries. The Asian countries are a little bit ahead of us, but their economies are much better, too. So we'll be taking on that issue. A reminder, just because I'm feeling the need for it, and you may be as well, tomorrow at 10 is comedy. Mark is our next caller, Professor Newman from Door County. Hi, Mark.
Hi. Yeah, similar to the last caller, it seems that before the November election, everybody was talking about how terrible the national debt is. And now, when we could do something about the national debt by repealing half or some of the Bush area tax cuts, everybody says, well, of course we can't. We must have these tax cuts. And yet, only about 3 or 4 weeks ago, everybody says, we've got to do something about the national debt.
Yeah, what about that, Professor Newman?
Well, I take Mark's point. I think it's a very important one, and I hope people will remember that when they think about exercising their rights as citizens in the ballot box. But I think it's fairly clear that when conservatives talk about reducing the national debt, they're talking about reducing spending on social programs. They are not talking about reducing tax cuts. They believe they believe that tax cuts are beneficial economically, and that they still harbor a love for trickle-down theory, much of which I think has been largely discredited. When liberals talk about the national debt, and I think they too are concerned about it, you know, they think that the national debt should be dealt with by closing those tax cuts down and by looking again at military expenditures. So everyone professes and I think genuinely believes that the national debt is an issue, how we get to addressing it is a source of great division politically. So I don't think that it's fair to say conservatives don't care about the national debt. I would say they do, but they only see one way forward, and that's cutting social spending. And I think it's also true that liberals care about it, but they want to see a fairer tax code, and they probably would look at military expenditures.
Thanks very much for the call. Professor Newman, can you come up with a plan? I'm thinking about unemployment again and about whether or not the administration should have taken this on rather than health care, although they said that you couldn't have one without the other. But I'm wondering if there is a plan that could receive bipartisan support that would put people back to work, which would conquer some of these problems.
Well, I don't know whether it would receive bipartisan support. I have to say that what I think ought to be done about unemployment probably would not be appealing to conservatives, but one would try and make a case with them anyway. And that is this. Sending people unemployment checks helps them stave off the absolute worst catastrophe they face in their households. But it does not address the employment problem. It does not put them in a position of keeping their skills alive or their resumes active, all of which is critical to their long-term success in the labor market. Even when the economy revives, people who've been unemployed for a long period of time face enormous uphill battles in finding new jobs. Hence, for all those reasons, I personally favor direct federal job creation of the kind we saw so successfully in the New Deal era. The WPA, the CWA, the CWA, which was a precursor to the better-known Works Progress Administration, created 4 million jobs in 3 months in the depths of the Great Depression. 4 million jobs. And that was a labor force way smaller than what we have now. Let's just imagine we created 4 million jobs now, here, in the economy we have now. Those people would be back at work. They would be earning money. They would be spending money. They would be far more optimistic about their futures. They would have experience to rely on such that when the economy revived, they wouldn't look like damaged goods. This is something that can be done. Now, you will hear conservatives scream about it and say that it's impractical or it's government doing the wrong thing. And my point is this. What is government for if not to provide people with opportunity to go back to work in order to protect their long-term capacity to work? If that is not a proper function of government, I honestly don't know what is. I worry tremendously about what is going to happen to this generation of young people whose pathway into the labor market is going to look so damaged. Is anyone going to remember when the economy revives, we hope 2 years from now, why they were unemployed? Is anyone going to remember that 55-year-old manager who'd worked for 30 years and was successful was unemployed for 2 years? Is anyone going to consider him or her employable again, even when the economy revives? I think the chances are dim. And it is appropriate for government, it seems to me, to step in and help us rebuild our schools, rebuild our roads, provide more care for the elderly, provide more teachers stop teachers from being laid off, make sure that firemen and policemen remain on the job. Those are proper functions of government. And, Franklin Roosevelt knew that, and that's why people were weeping in the streets when he died, because he remembered that what they needed most wasn't a handout. What they needed most was a job. And this is not to in any way replace the role of the private sector in job generation. In the end, the private sector is the very best instrument for creating employment and sustaining it. But in a period like this, in which the private sector isn't moving, we need alternatives to rely on, at least temporarily, to put our people back to work so that they can stay at work once the economy revives. And, to those who say it can't be done or it shouldn't be done, I point to 1933, 1934, and ask them, wasn't that a better way? Didn't it give the nation hope? And isn't it an appropriate function for government? And at least from my point of view, the answer to that is a resounding yes.
And do you think also that that may have been one of the reasons that people were weeping in the streets when President Obama was elected, and it's one of the reasons that they are quite disappointed in him, many Democrats are?
Well, I think that Obama was fairly honest about his centrist leanings. The person, sadly, who was talking most about the issues that I'm raising now was not Obama. It was Edwards.
Right.
And for all of his failings as a human being, he was the person who was talking most strongly and with greatest conviction about what the nation needed to do for the poor and and about unemployment. Those were not issues that Obama raised. And, you know, he has a much stronger centrist profile. So is this the reason people are disappointed? If they're disappointed, they weren't listening very carefully to the campaign rhetoric, which was really not about these issues, much as personally I think it should have been and much as I think John Edwards was trying to raise the question. So I think those people who are disappointed don't really have a complete right to be disappointed because they elected a centrist who is behaving like a centrist. But he's also behaving like a pragmatic politician, and I'm not a politician, so I'm not bound by the same constraints. He is trying to preserve the best deal I think he feels he can get for the nation's poor and unemployed by extending unemployment insurance and making sure that's not vulnerable, which it has been, and by preserving the earned income tax credit. But we're paying a very, very heavy price for that in the form of protection for the people who least need it at the very top.
Let's go to Maria next from Johnson Creek. Hi, Maria.
Good morning. This topic is, I couldn't ask for a better topic. I'm 45. My husband is 50. He quit his job of 14 years to start our own company. Cashing out 401k, that was a hit, 40%. But we could hire, with what my husband does, we could hire hundreds of people. But we had to buy all our equipment by ourselves, one piece at a time. Had we had a little help, right now today, my husband's out working, he could have an employee with him at $20 an hour with health insurance. But it costs me money up front. I have to pay in $1,000 for workman's compensation and all these issues that had I had just a little help, we could grow this company to employ lots of people with a good, healthy wage. And what drives me nuts, like they went, President Obama came to Menominee Falls to this small business company, and this is what our stimulus money did. You know what? That company was part of Johnson Controls. That wasn't a little company. Of course they got the stimulus money. Am I going to get that stimulus money to give 10 people this year, 20 people next year, 50 people, 100 people, you know, 5 years from now? No, we're just going to have to do it one person at a time and pay 40% in taxes.
Did you need did you have problems borrowing from a bank to start this business, Professor or Maria?
Because it was that nobody's lending money. It didn't matter if you had good credit or bad credit. It didn't matter, and we could show them, look, we've got $20,000 worth of. I mean, we literally bought one piece at a time before my husband quit. It was like, okay, we buy a pump, we buy a generator, we buy the welder. You know, and we could go to the bank and say, oh, look, if we just borrowed $10,000, I have work waiting for me, but I need these tools to get the job done. Well, you know, why don't you come back to us in 6 months?
Oh, my.
In 6 months, I won't need you.
Right.
And we are so blessed at what he has learned. We have tripled our income, and this is our very first year.
Professor Newman, they want to hire people.
Well, I think the caller raises a lot of very important issues. There is clearly some degree of uncertainty in the business community, but I have to confess that I don't completely understand it. At the small business level, I understand it better. At the very top end, I find this a bit baffling, and I'm not sure that the rhetoric we hear is completely straightforward. We have record productivity now. We have never had such high productivity. Now, what does that mean? What it means is firms are able to get way more work out of the existing labor force than they've been able to get before. That's what record high productivity means. And as long as they can push that productivity up higher and higher without paying higher wages and without hiring more people, we will see very little incentive for them to begin hiring. And I do think that's an important part of this picture that is not remarked on in the press very much. Most of what we hear about is uncertainty with respect to health care and whatnot. And, you know, I just don't completely buy that, because I just think that they're able to squeeze more work out of the people who are already on the payroll, and this is limiting the incentive to hire. As inventories go down, we will see more hiring go on, but at the moment we've seen a lot of functions automated that previously took human beings, and so that's one of the reasons why we don't see more hiring, because there's more automation. We've seen more offshoring. You know, the search for ever cheaper labor forces overseas. You know, at the end of the day, perhaps it's some of the regulatory environment that's involved there, but I'm really somewhat skeptical of that question. The health care bill, much as it might impose some requirements on firms, also was going to remove some burdens that firms have faced, as they have increasingly had to shoulder burdens of health care payments on their own. And in fact, the minute health care was announced, we had private health insurance companies ratcheting up their premiums on employers in ways that I don't think had any justification whatsoever. So there's a lot of shenanigans going on out there. Nonetheless, the problem the caller faced in borrowing is a very big part of this. We, the citizens, gave the banks a ton of money,
yes,
the purpose of which was to start the flow of lending again, lending in the housing markets, lending in the small business markets, and it just hasn't happened at the rate it was supposed to happen. And I do think the banks need to be called to account on that, because without that liquidity, business expansion is affected, the housing markets remain stagnant or falling, and that was the whole purpose of restoring the banks, which have become quite profitable.
Well, it was strange to me. This kind of stuck in my mind when we had this strange afternoon when President Clinton took over President Obama's press conference and became president again for about a half hour. And he was talking, did you see that? He was talking about the banks and saying the money's there. There are trillions of dollars.
That's right.
And I'm thinking when he's saying that, there are trillions of dollars all boxed up in these banks when people need the money. What the heck is going on?
Well, I don't have a good answer for that question. And clearly, if President Clinton doesn't have a good answer for it, none of us do. And it is a mystery. It suggests, you know, that the kinds of strictures and controls that were placed on the money we gave the banks weren't sufficient, that they were given money without requirements to lend it, and instead they're hoarding it. And this is making life miserable for millions of Americans, because they can't get home loans, which means they can't enter the real estate market, and that is depressing real estate values, and it means that they can't get jobs because banks are not lending to employers who need that capital to expand, as they always have. They always have relied on banks for this
right.
purpose.
Professor Catherine Newman is our guest this hour. She is a widely published expert on poverty and the working poor. She is at Johns Hopkins University, where she is dean of the School of Arts and Sciences. And she's written 9 books and is writing 2 more books right now, focusing on the lives of the working poor and mobility up and down the economic ladder. Here's our phone number. Our lines have been crowded, but keep trying. You'll get on. I'm glad there's a lot of interest in this topic. It shows we are all engaged citizens. Our number is 800-486-8655. 800. Oh, no, it's not. That's our, darn it. I do that all the time. I'm in Madison. 800-642-1234 is the number. Sorry. 800-642-1234. Okay, and our email is talk@wpr.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. The second hour of our program today, it's actually a related topic during economic times that are tough. What do we do with our colleges and universities? Do we try to give them more money so we can train more workers? Because if you go to college, you have a better chance of getting a job. There have been huge demonstrations, as I'm sure you're aware of, in England over the last couple of weeks, where there has been a vote to increase the tuition that college students will pay in England. What's going on in France? What about China and Thailand and the United States? Our guest, senior research fellow at the Center for Studies in Higher Education, who has at Berkeley, who's done a whole lot of work in this area and has done a paper on looking at access, equity, public universities all over the world. Professor Catherine Newman is our guest now. And let's go to an email from Brett. Obama's conservative deficit commission will be recommend paying for these income and estate tax cuts by making cuts to Medicare and Social Security and borrowing more money from China. Obama will sadly go along with their recommendations. Do you agree, Professor Newman?
Well, I don't know about the borrowing money from China part, but I imagine that the caller is talking about this in terms of the deficit. I think that he's probably got a point there. Basically, what we're looking at is something that people decry all the time, which is class warfare, but it is a form of class warfare. It's saying that we're going to provide those at the very top with a lot of benefits in order to modestly protect those at the bottom, and that those are class interests that are being fought over here. And it's probably best that we recognize that's the case. I think, the only thing I can say in Obama's defense is I think he probably has got the deal, the best deal he thinks he can get, given who we have in Congress. Whether it really is the best deal he could get, it's hard for me to say. But he's not dealing with an easy playing field. That much is the case. And we elected these people, and they are very adamant that they want to protect those benefits for those at the very top. I'm not the one who voted for them, but, a majority of, look at the election results. This is who the American people voted for, and I hope that they now understand what it is they bargained for.
You were mentioning FDR. One of our listeners, Jeanette from Milwaukee, listen to this. It's just so striking because we don't hear this kind of conversation, except maybe from Bernie Sanders. He's a solo voice in many ways. In 1932, Roosevelt said, "Must the country remain hungry and jobless while raw materials stand unused and factories idle? The country demands bold, persistent experimentation. Take a method and try it. If it fails, admit it frankly and try another. But above all, try something."
Yeah, well, I think those are exactly the right questions to be asked now. The New Deal in its own time was quite a controversial piece of legislation, several pieces of legislation. There were conservatives then who thought it was a terrible idea. I wrote a book called Who Cares, which we just published last year, which looks extensively at the debates in the 1930s over Roosevelt's New Deal. And there were loud cries that this was a terrible thing to do, and there were equally loud cries on the left that it was about time and wasn't even strong enough. So these are never simple matters. There are always divisions in the United States. But I do think we have a track record to look at from the New Deal era in which we had massive, massive unemployment, way worse than we have now, far fewer instruments for attacking it, a brand new sort of experiment in the form of public employment, and it worked. It put people back to work. It did not cure the whole depression. It took the Second World War, which was another form of government employment in the form of putting people into the armed forces, to bring that horrible chapter of our lives to a close. But it cut unemployment in half in just the space of a couple of years, in half.
Mm-hmm.
If we could cut unemployment in half now, I don't think we would be having these arguments.
No, we'd be happier people. Well, we got to get a copy of that book and do a show down the road. That'd be great. Let's go to Brian from Dubuque next. Hi, Brian.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Uh-huh.
Just wanted to ask your guest, Professor Newman, just what her thoughts were on the inheritance tax. She mentioned that she was discouraged about that. And my previous thoughts about that were that I guess I was just a little bit confused on the inheritance tax. I guess when somebody passes and leaves an inheritance, why is that taxed once again?
The inheritance taxes came into the American tax code sometime in the early 20th century, as I recall. I'm not a historian, and I don't know the whole story, but inheritance taxes have been part of our sort of social compact, if you will, on the theory that people who you know, pile up very large estates, should have to return something to the national coffers. It's a form of redistribution. It's not altogether different from the income tax, in which those who have much, you know, who earn much more pay a significantly higher tax bill. You would need to do a whole other program to look into the history of inheritance taxes. I would say, however, it's pretty firmly involved in our tax code. Now, what's at issue in the current bill is who pays inheritance taxes. So people of modest means have never paid inheritance taxes. Inheritance taxes kicked in above, I believe the current mark is something like $5 million. The estate had to be above $5 million, which is, there's so few Americans who are at that level that inheritance taxes really only apply to a tiny number of people. The argument has sometimes been made that they will affect people in the small business world, but that I really do think is a complete fabrication. It's a very, very, very rare small business that reaches those kinds of numbers. So that mainly what we're talking about here is quite wealthy families. And this was probably a something that came in the period of the robber barons. There were lots of tax changes that occurred in the early part of the 20th century that were spurred on by this tremendous sense of inequality when we had people like the Fricks and the Rockefellers and so on. And there were changes in the taxes that they paid. But it was mostly people up at that level who were affected, and that's still true today. So what the bill has done now is lower the point at which there's freedom from those tax burdens from $5 million to $3.5 million. I believe that's the current proposal on the books. But inheritance taxes are another form of redistribution, just as the income tax is. And the theory is that those who have been very, very wealthy in life, should be asked to pay more than those of us who have been more modest.
Thanks for the call. Let's go to Stephen from La Crosse next. Hi, Stephen.
Hello. Can you hear me?
Uh-huh.
Okay. So my comment is I don't see that there's really any justification for having capital gains taxes at lower rates than personal income tax rates. If I consider somebody that might earn $70,000 a year through blood, sweat, working, going into the office every single day, and I don't know, I don't have the income tax table in front of me, but let's assume that their tax rate is certainly above 20%, their incremental tax rate. Someone at home with investments may be able to earn passive income of $70,000 a year in interest and capital gains on those investments and do nothing, not put any effort into the earnings of that income, end up paying a lower tax rate than someone that actually goes in and gives so much of themselves back to the society through their economic output, through their efforts. So I don't see that there's any, I don't know how anybody could justify that person that's actually sitting there doing nothing and earning this passive income would owe less to society, less giving back than someone that's actually contributing.
All right, Professor Newman.
Well, I guess the theory behind lower capital gains is that it will spur more investment. I'm not an economist, and I don't have a strong opinion about how often that's the case. I do know that most economists agree that those at the very highest end of the income spectrum, when given tax breaks, tend to save the money rather than spend it, so it doesn't have the kind of stimulative effect that we really need to get people back to work. As to whether or not lower capital gains taxes does spur investment, I imagine that there is some evidence for that, but whether it's enough evidence to justify the kind of tax break we provide for capital gains is another matter, and there I suspect I probably fall closer to the caller's point of view than to a conservative point of view. One question that has been at issue here is the offshoring of businesses that basically take their tax dollars out of the country altogether. And there are huge loopholes that permit corporations to do this, and basically to run away with their dollars and avoid taxation altogether, or at a very, very low rate. And this has been a matter of considerable controversy. I do think there is very limited, really not much of a justification for those kinds of differences. And, you know, we would see a lot lower tax burden on the rest of the country if there was a more equalized tax statute of that kind.
You know, the more I listen to you and think about these issues, they're so huge, aren't they? They cover not only a lack of a coherent plan, but a will, a philosophy, really, in this country to look at what's fair for everybody, how much is enough for everybody, and kind of this stagnation about everything. It's actually rather depressing that we can't move forward on it. We just can't seem to agree on the fact that it's a good thing for people to have work and to not be in poverty and to write letters to Santa Claus asking for mittens and a hat. There's something wrong.
Well, I agree with you. I think there should be a basic social compact that the country owes a decent standard of living to its people and has the right to expect them to work to make that possible. But then it's got to provide work opportunities so that people can realistically be asked to do that. I mean, I am not a big fan of of unemployment. I'm even less of a fan of welfare programs. And most of the people I know who've been in them hate them as well. What they really want is a decent job at a decent wage so that they can fulfill their responsibilities to their families and to their country. And I think the vast, vast majority of Americans totally accept that responsibility. They're just looking for a way to fulfill it. And I would much rather see government step in and help them help themselves by providing employment when the private markets can't do so than see them sit on the sidelines and let their skills rot so that even when the economy recovers, they're unemployable. I mean, this is a catastrophe. I think that we should expect people to work, and I think we should expect government to step in and help when the private markets can't satisfy the demand for employment. And that is a much better way of doing things than just paying people to do nothing and feel depressed and isolated because they're removed from the most important sort of stage on which adults need to stand.
Right. Let's go to Tom from Spooner next. Hi, Tom.
Hi, how are you this morning?
All right, how are you, Tom?
Good. So I really enjoy your program. I appreciate it. Appreciate you letting me on and visiting with your guest today. I do have a question for her, if I can. Have you ever employed anybody or owned a business yourself?
I have. I do a lot of consulting work, which is sort of, when I have the time to, which is a sort of a business on the side, if you will. many research experts do that, and I have employed research assistants and teaching assistants, but I've not run a small business, and I do appreciate that there are many things I don't know about running small businesses.
Do you run a small business, Tom?
I do.
Okay.
And, I employ people, and I borrow money from banks, and I generate income and profits and revenue, And I appreciate your discussion, but I really disagree with you. In fact, most of the time I really listen a lot, and I listen to both sides of radio. And, I had a overwhelming gut reaction to a lot of the things that your speaker was talking about today from the fact that a lot of it is just flat out wrong. Academically, it probably is accurate, but from a get out here, get your hands dirty, and get something done and employ people and generate a profit only to have to deal with workers' comp and deal with unemployment insurance and deal with paying federal taxes, state taxes. There is so much out there that the government actually restricts us from actually employing people and making a profit in our business. And all you're trying to tell us is that we need more, that we're not doing enough.
I think you really misunderstand me here. When I say we need to do more, or you need to do more, I mean the whole country needs to do more, not that you alone need to do more. But let me ask you a question. Should we have a system of workers' compensation? And if so, how should it be paid for? When people are injured on the job, should they be provided with support while they recover or not? Because let's start with that and then ask how it should be paid for.
Well, in Wisconsin, of course, we have a good system of workers' compensation, and I don't think it's a bad thing. In fact, I've had, one claim over the past 15 years where they've actually taken care of that person, and I think that's a good thing.
So what is it that you object to when you say, if we agree that there should be a workers' compensation system, and you seem to think so, and I certainly seem to think so, then what is the issue for you that you feel is an intrusive government regulation.
And we have about 40 seconds, everybody.
Okay. Well, you know, partly I think what, you know, I take exception with you is that, you know, the private business can't, let me rephrase that. That private businesses create jobs. You think the government should create the jobs, such as the public works back in
No. Let me be clear.
All right. I'm sorry, everybody. We've only got about 10 seconds.
And the private sector can't do it, government should step in, but fundamentally the private sector is the driver.
All right, and on that note, I'm sorry, Tom, we got to go. I'm not cutting you off, but we're plumb out of time. Professor Newman, thank you so much for the hour. It was very stimulating.
My pleasure.
Thanks. Professor Catherine Newman, our guest this hour of the program, she's a widely published expert, Poverty and the Working Poor. She is dean of the School of Arts and Sciences at Johns Hopkins University. Thanks to Chrissy Pease for producing the hour. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for doing a board operation here in Madison. We're in Madison today. And Dave Protas for doing on-air production. Thanks, Dave, very much. And thanks, everybody, for all of your calls. Somewhat related, in economic hard times, what's the role of universities in retraining people? And what about tuitions going up substantially and protests as a result of that? All of that's on the table the second hour of the show.